is you gave us 167 episode of Growing Pains. I feel like Alan Thicke has already contributed enough to the world. He's done enough. He should be retired, but here he is working hard this morning on the Kevin DeBean Show on K-Rock. Hi, Mr. Thicke. How are you, sir?
Excellent. Thank you. So apparently I raised you, boys.
Yes. Well, you raised America, sir. Come
okay.
on.
Okay. Well, just mind your manners or I'll spank you.
Alan Thicke is back with a new TV show called Unusually Thicke, a little different from shows you have previously been on because this is a quote-unquote reality series. It airs on the TV Guide Network, and it premiered last Wednesday night. Why are you letting the cameras follow you around, Alan?
Well, the truth is that it's not really a reality show. We call it a reality sitcom. It's the real family mm-hmm. in real situations that we're involved in, but told in kind of a sitcom story format. You know, I didn't want to be so presumptuous as to think that we were that fabulous that you could follow us around in our underwear and have a TV show. So, you know, we bring in some celebrities for a little joke here and there to help us tell the story, and we're going for the light approach as opposed to the wine-tossing, hair-pulling approach.
You're also going for the truthful approach, which is to say up front, this is not 100% reality, which most of the other ones are trying to pull off.
True. You know, we're probably more real than a lot of reality shows in that it's, again, real people and our real emotions, reactions. It's who we really are. It's kind of like, you know, if you do remember Growing Pains, it's like Jason Seaver saying, come on over, you know, meet the real family.
Right.
Yeah. See if you like them.
Now, let's talk about some of you, because, look, you've been in show business for a long time. You've got lots of celebrity friends, and the Hoff is on your show, and Bob Saget stops by, and, of course, your kid, Robin Thicke, that guy, he's on the show.
Yeah, Robin's on tonight.
Oh, tonight's episode. Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. But I want to talk about you as a Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
Having Wayne Gretzky on the show. Now, do you just weep when you're in the presence of the great one?
I do. You know, Wayne is is still Wayne. You know, that's all. And he and I go back to when he was about 18 years old. In fact, I met him right here in Los Angeles. I produced the NHL All-Star Banquet the year that it was here back
in
the 80s.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and Wayne was like 18, and I produced it in exchange for them giving the proceeds to my charity, which is the Diabetes Foundation, and that began a long, fabulous relationship.
So were you friends with him throughout the years that he was playing in the NHL?
Yeah, I was kind of part of his introduction to Los Angeles and making him comfortable and not intimidated. You know, Canadian boy from the backwoods like we all were, feeling acclimated in L.A., and I like to think that that was part of my contribution.
So when he was having trouble, they would say, get Thicke on the phone. We need him right now.
That's it. I'll sort it out right now. Yeah, yeah. I wasn't exactly the Dave Semenko, you know, the guy who would beat up the opposition if Wayne had problems. But.
So, Alan, so if I'm not extrapolating this incorrectly, so you becoming friends with Wayne Gretzky, making him comfortable in Los Angeles, probably influencing his decision to come play for the Kings, kind of is what made hockey a thing in Southern California. You are actually responsible for the Ducks and the Kings even being here.
And the Sharks. I think I'm about 100% responsible, and I should be getting a piece of every ticket sale. In California.
Is that happening?
Not yet. But okay. We're talking.
Okay.
Well, I know you're a Kings fan.
Mostly to myself.
I know you're a Kings fan, as is Kevin, and he's very depressed today. How are you feeling, sir?
It was an unfortunate probably end to our season last night, going down 3-0. I mean, they're tough guys, and it's not unprecedented that you can come back from 3-0, but the Sharks look pretty strong.
That's the problem, is you can come back if you're down 3-0 against a team that's just playing average. Sometimes you can pull that off. They look great.
Sharks, they look strong.
Super annoying.
They have the speed. They got snipers.
Couldn't hit them more.
Yeah, it'd be tough.
Now, do you? I heard that at one point you were or are in a celebrity hockey league.
Oh, I formed it years ago. The very first celebrity team was
Alan Thicke has layers here, you guys.
Sit down, wait. Sit down. Will you hear this one? Years ago, along with Alex Trebek and Matthew Perry's father. We're talking about the early 1900s now.
Right, sure. Okay.
We put together the celebrity hockey. They had to play some charity exhibitions around, and then it became a thing, and we're still doing it all over the North America.
Are you good?
Mediocre with gusts of adequacy. I played college level in Canada.
Oh, you did?
In the early 1900s.
But you have to in Canada. I mean, that's a requirement.
You skate out of the delivery room there. But I'm now I'm a lane clogger. Mostly I go up and
just
down
get in the
wall.
Way and block shots.
Yeah. And I do that, and I clot well.
Good.
So when I bleed, they can get me off the ice in a hurry and not make a mess.
You have the craziest life. Have you written a book yet, Alan?
I've written two. Thanks for reading them.
I knew I shouldn't have asked that question.
One's called How Men Have Babies, The Pregnant Father Survival Guide, and the other was How to Raise Kids Who Won't Hate You. And both of which have done reasonably well. They're semi-instructional. I sort of what I did was I researched with people who actually know what they're talking about, you know, psychologists, educators, et cetera, and then I add my own spin and anecdotes, and I enjoy that. My first career was as a writer. I was a writer in Variety Television for 10 years before I was ever on TV. I wrote for you know, a lot of the comics who had shows. I wrote for Bill Cosby, Richard Pryor, Flip Wilson.
Well, if you want the true African American experience, you go to Alan Thicke to get those jokes on the page, right?
This is it. I am from the deep south of Ontario, Canada.
Alan also produced the revolutionary Fernwood Tonight for old people like me who remember what a groundbreaking show that was, and America Tonight also for the great Norman Lear. I mean, you've had an unbelievable show business career. You're famous as a father in real life, and of course, we see that on the Unusually Thicke reality show as well. Do you keep in touch with the TV kids? Because you're also famous as a TV dad.
You know, I never cared for them. truth is, we're all close. We wouldn't have a birthday party or a Halloween party without inviting each other. In one of our episodes on Unusually Thicke, we reunite the cast of Growing Pains.
Oh, how about that?
A barbecue at the ranch. Yeah,
that sounds fun. Unusually Thicke airs Wednesday nights at 10 on the TV Guide Network. So much more to talk about with our guest, Alan Thicke. We'll return in a moment here on K-Rock. Show business legend Alan Thicke in studio with us here on the Kevin and Bean Show. Unusually Thicke, which, by the way, was your nickname in college, wasn't it, Kevin?
It was my nickname, yes.
You were Thicke. They called you Thicke back in college. Alan's new series premiered last week on the TV Guide Network, and it's going to be on again tonight and every Wednesday night at 10 o'clock. Don't miss this. Where do you rank Dr. Seaver in the all-time pantheon of television dads, Alan?
I would say one, number one.
What kind of question is that? Is he going to say last?
Others may
Screw Dr. Huxtable.
There was some official poll conducted by People Magazine or somebody a couple of years ago, and I think I finished somewhere in the middle of the pack of the top 50.
All right,
They jammed a couple in there before who clearly stuffed the ballot box.
Sure,
But I was honored to be under consideration.
Now, all your family appears on Unusually Thicke, including your beautiful bride, Tanya. How long have you been married to her?
We've been married 9 years. Been together for about 14.
Okay. And she is how much younger than you are, Mr. Thicke?
Well, she's legal now. she is. I met her when she was 24, which makes her 28 years.
Math. Hang on a second.
Come on, 28 years younger. Nice. Why am I the only one applauding?
Well, you know, she's the same age as my sons, who I love dearly. So I figured, you know, why just by association, that would be a great demographic too.
But we've often had this conversation. What a weird world it must be if you get a quote new mom and she's your age as a kid. Strange.
They all
especially if she's hot.
It's uncomfortable.
It's really weird.
They interpret each other to me.
Okay,
you know?
I see. She helps you understand the kids, and the kids help you understand her.
Yeah, a great compatibility filter. We don't want to be in a society of ageism, do we? I mean, middle-aged patriarchs need love, too.
That's correct.
Absolutely.
I would hate to think that we're prejudiced, biased.
So she grew up, though, watching you on TV. So when she met you, it was a huge deal for her to meet Alan Thicke.
We kind of met over the phone or through a gig that we were going to be doing together, where she was a model and I was doing the entertainment for an event in Florida. And she thought that she was meeting Mr. Belding, the principal from Saved by the Bell.
Oh, no.
Is that true?
Yeah, it's true. And then later on, when we had a relationship, and she announced to her Bolivian family down there in Santa Cruz that she was marrying the guy from Growing Pains, they thought it was Kirk Cameron.
So, oh my God!
So I've never been. She wasn't able to ever take me down to Bolivia and break their poor
heart. Is she sure who you are now?
No. I have told her that I am Bruce Springsteen.
Okay. Yeah. That's a good choice.
And if she ever sees a picture, we're in trouble.
So Robin Thicke, your beloved son, Grammy Award winning Robin Thicke, he's on the show tonight on Usually Thicke on the TV Guide Network. Are you surprised? Now, be honest with me here. Don't just be a dad, and of course you support your kids in their chosen career, but are you surprised at what an enormously successful recording artist he has become?
I think we were all surprised, including Robin, at the enormity of that particular record. Not that that record didn't deserve it, but no record has ever done what that what Blurred Lines did last summer.
You know, it's the best-selling download in the history of Great Britain.
Yeah, exactly. So, So you know, it was a pioneering record in that sense. But in terms
but
of his,
a lot of that was due to the video. Let's be honest.
Video didn't hurt. I understand that he had a video and that there were women in it.
That's correct.
I must make a point of seeing that.
You
someday.
Should. You should look that up.
And but no, I'm surprised at his artistry and the fact that he's been as successful as he has been. No, I'm not surprised. He was terrific as a 15 and 16 year old. He already had those kind of chops, and he had 15. Platinum records, writing and producing for other people before he was artist himself.
Christina Aguilera,
Usher, Lil Wayne.
Wow. Unbelievable.
He was all over the charts. Yeah, he was all over the charts.
Your family has the Midas touch, Alan. It's insane.
Well, you know, we're kind of the Baldwins without rehab. you know, we're all over the place. My brother Todd produces America's Funniest Videos, and I think my 16-year-old Carter is a natural. I don't want to tell him how good he is on this show yet because we've got to keep him focused on law school. But
sure.
He's
a
wonderful,
a great lawyer.
Wonderful young man. And my eldest son Brennan is a business entrepreneur, not far from your very studios here. He and his wife have a custom wedding dress company, and he has a medical marijuana dispensary.
Now you're talking.
So,
yeah.
Now you're talking.
So
come on, give it up.
I brag that they're a one-stop shopping center for the most memorable wedding ever.
Not memorable. Right?
Listen to Lisa going, "Oh wow," and the wedding dress guy, like she's ever going to need one. Come on, Alan. You talked about your son in the music and how successful Robin Thicke is. But before you go, I have to ask you about this because I'm so fascinated with this. How many television theme songs have you written that have run on the air?
About 46.
What?
No, only a few of which, you know, lasted and that you would know.
Name them. Some of them.
Different Strokes.
Yes.
Which I also sang. Facts of Life.
Right there, you should be in the TV Hall of Fame for just writing the Facts of Life and the Different Strokes themes.
Wrote a lot of game show themes.
Like what?
Wheel of Fortune, the original Wheel of Fortune. Ran for 8 years, and then they went in syndication, and Merv Griffin replaced mine with his because he needed to buy the rest of the Bahamas.
So did you start out as a musician or something? How did you learn how to write all these music?
No, I was mediocre. I was in bar bands and fraternity bands and played around with that for a year or so. So I had a functional six chords and dropped any of those aspirations as soon as Robin was 15 and was so much better than me and I could just kind of celebrate and enjoy his artistry. But I had great fun dabbling in it and made a couple. I had some songs recorded by some other R&B artists back in the day. Not hits, but album cuts. The
nice,
Spinners
though.
And Al Jarreau and Lou Rawls and people like
that. Is there one thing that you haven't done?
Well, there's plenty of things I haven't done particularly well.
Okay.
The truth is, the great fun of my career has been the variety of it. And if I ever could have done anything great, then I would have done that. You You know, I'm doing
a bunch of things.
I've called myself the fast food renaissance man, kind of a master of B talents. If I could have grown up to be, Robin Williams or Robin Thicke, I would have, you know. But instead, I've had a lot of fun with a lot of stuff.
All right, I have a serious question about your family dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Does the TV show put a lot of pressure on that?
It doesn't, because of the way we did it. As I said, we tell our stories and did the show in a sitcom kind of format. So although the dialogue is improvised, we had a plot. You know, we know where
we're
going.
You're going
we want to tell a story. So it's not like they were around, trying to, calculate how many times we go to the bathroom in a day and hope that
right.
would be
that's a show I would watch.
Riveting television. You know? So we kind of plotted our scenes. We knew what we wanted to say.
Yeah.
So when you're, and we're in our final moments here with the great Alan Thicke, and again, the program Unusually Thicke airs again tonight and every Wednesday on the TV Guide Network. Please, please check it out. It's very funny. So when you're at home flipping around on the TV, it must be such an experience for you, because you click on this one channel. Oh, I was in that show. Click on this next channel. Oh, I wrote the theme for that. Click on the next channel. Oh, I used to be married to her. I mean, I would just imagine that you can't come across anything on TV that you don't have some sort of at least tangential relationship to.
I have to check myself every while, because I bore the hell out of my children and my wife by watching television and saying, I remember back in 1983, and
they're gone already.
I do have, and then who is he talking about? Go wipe his chin. Go wipe the drool up, Dad. So, there are lots of memories.
That's your next book. Wipe the drool off, Dad.
Yeah. Where's the oatmeal, Pops?
What a life you have had, Alan Thicke, and I'm so glad that you gave us a few minutes of it. So much fun to meet you. Thanks for stopping by the Kevin DeBede Show.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Coachella tickets you can win at 9 o'clock this morning, like we're doing every day all this week, like we've been doing this whole month. Are you broadcasting from the desert on Friday, Kevin?
Yes, sir.
Oh, you're going to be a mess.
Friday and Monday.
You're going to be a mess.
Yeah. Friday, not so much. Monday, that's going to be rough.
So you can win your tickets, and if you're going to be going out to Coachella, I think there are going to be some events that you can swing by the K-Rock house and see some stuff. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. We'll be unveiling more as we get a little bit closer to the weekend. That's all coming up.
Bob Larson, Arizona Reverend, offers exorcisms via Skype.
Convenient.
Well, absolutely convenient. Because sometimes it's so hard to get an appointment with your exorcist.
Yes. If you've got a demon inside you, all you need is a computer, and this guy will have him cast out by Skype.
I am a little bit surprised
awesome.
To hear that, just because, now granted, all I know about exorcisms is what I've seen in movies, but they seem awfully violent.
They do, yeah.
And I just
and stubborn, too.
Yeah, I just can't imagine that a demon would just sit in front of a computer screen and talk to you.
But on the other side of it, they usually try to go into somebody else in the room.
Ah.
So you're safe if you're doing the exorcism.
Good point.
From your home or wherever he does it.
These exorcisms are a real thing that people do. This guy, Bob Larson, claims that he has performed more than 20,000 of them in the last 40 years. That's a lot of damn demons.
Wow.
More than 20,000. In case you're wondering, a 60-minute Skype exorcism cost about $295, which seems like a reasonable fee for somebody to remove the devil from your soul.
If you have the devil in your soul, that is not that much money.
So we can't afford that, but we asked producer Dave if there's any way we could get Mr. Larson on the phone, and I believe we're Skyping in with him. Is that right? We're actually going to – I think we're set up to – And there he is right now on the screen.
Good morning. How are y'all?
Hi, Mr. Larson. Now, this is not
Reverend Larson, please, if you would.
So sorry.
I say Reverend Larson.
Reverend Larson, yeah. So this is not, you're not charging us the $300. We get a complimentary 3 minutes or something?
Absolutely. I'm not charging you. Although I have, if you do use my service, it is a tax-deductible donation to the International Missions Program.
So, well, that's nice.
Not only do I free your soul from Satan, but it's also tax-deductible as well.
Now, why are there so many demons? How have you performed 20,000 exorcisms?
Excellent question. Why are there so many demons? I like to blame the gays.
Really?
What? Yeah. And the Jews.
Really?
What are you talking about?
This groups you don't like?
No, I believe it's all part of Satan's plan to possess us. So usually if you're gay, you got a devil inside you. Or if you're a Jew.
I don't think that's at all factually accurate, Reverend.
Well, we'll have to agree to disagree on this one point. Because I have done 20,000 exorcisms. Mostly on Jews and gays.
Now, when did you realize or come up with the idea that maybe you could do it on Skype?
Well, there was a man in Norwegia.
In Norwegia?
Norway.
Yes, he was Norwegian. He lived in Norwegia.
Norway. The country's called Norway, Reverend.
Right. And he had a devil inside him.
Right.
And he said he could not come to me, and I just had no interest really traveling to him. So we tried doing it over this here Skype that we got going, and it was amazing the success I had.
Hmm. Now, one expert in the field who is the director of the International Catholic Association of Exorcists mm-hmm. says that exorcisms cannot be done over the internet.
What's his name, the man you're quoting? You remember?
Yes, it's Isaac Kramer.
Hmm, Jew.
Okay, but what does that have to do with it?
Unnatural hatred for Jews.
I'm just saying he sounds like a Jew.
Even
Isaac
if
Kramer?
Right, but even if he is, that doesn't mean he doesn't.
I'm guessing he's gay, too.
Why would you say that? He's just saying.
I just get a distinct feeling of penis.
It sounds like okay. Sounds like you need an exorcism of some sort.
Actually, I'll have you know, one of you there, was there a bean there?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Why do you ask, Reverend?
Well, your producer said many of the people who work there with you at the station being believed that you are actually possessed by a demon.
Oh,
and they've
come
asked
on.
Me if I would cast that out.
That's probably true.
Yeah, and I said I would, in exchange for this little interview, I'd do it free of charge. I would cast you out via Skype. I would get rid of the demon inside
That's
you.
Great.
So why do you have this demon inside you, Bean?
I don't have question. I'm neither gay nor Jewish, and I don't have any demons inside of me. I'm
well,
fine.
Let's see if I can hear the demon inside you. Let me just listen real quick.
Where's the plane? I want to know where the plane is. Because I'm going to send all those people to hell. Where's the plane? I check every morning and I check at night and I can't find the plane.
That's I think there's a demon inside.
That's wow. inside me. That's a demon. Terrifying.
I will cast it out. Get out of here, demon. You evil demon of... of Asperger's. Get the Asperger's out of him, please.
No, I'm not leaving. I like maps. It's Monday. That's IHOP day. Blah, blah.
Wow, that is a tough demon. Get out of here. I demand, in the name of Christ, I compel you, demon. Get out of this giant, lanky, weird-looking body. Get out, demon, out.
No, I'm not getting out. I like it in here. There's plenty of room because the organs are leaving one by one. It's nice and spacious.
No.
Well, there you go.
Well done. Thank you, Reverend.
How about a brand new Bean's Death Corner?
Hey, everybody. Gather all the kiddies around the radio. It's time for Bean's Death Corner.
Bean loves death any time of day. He gets all giddy and screams, hooray.
There's something wrong in his head. Death.
We don't know what's wrong with Bean, but now you'll get to see what we mean.
Oh, Bean loves death. Oh, Bean loves death.
I love death.
You're with me on the death, Ralph. Death is awesome.
No, I'm the opposite of your position. I believe life is infinitely more awesome than death.
Well, let's see if I can turn you around by taking a look at the stories in today's Bean's Death Corner. Police say they believe a woman in North Carolina was posting to Facebook just seconds before she was killed in a fatal car crash. By the way, anyone who's on the roads anywhere in this country, it's almost impossible to find a car that doesn't have somebody using his phone while they're driving, right?
Yes, those people should die.
Well, this one did die.
Oh, good.
Crash happened in High Point, North Carolina on Thursday morning. A 32-year-old, Courtney Ann Sanford, got in a head-on collision when she crossed the median and crashed into a truck. Her car went off the road and caught fire. The truck in the crash ran off the road and hit a tree, by the way. But fortunately, the truck driver was not injured, just the woman who was Facebooking. She posted at 8:33 a.m. The wreck happened at 8:34 a.m., by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Investigators say the Facebook post said, "The happy song makes me happy."
So she's just buzzing down the road listening to Pharrell.
And yep.
She felt she had to put that on Facebook.
Yes.
Rather than
great
pay
morning.
Attention to her drive.
It was discovered that she had also posted photos as she drove down the roadway.
Son
Pharrell
of a bitch.
Killed a woman. That's
Son
what
of a
happened.
Bitch. Good for him. Give him another hat. Hey, that is Darwinism in progress.
All the popes were in the news a few days ago. I guess it was Sunday. I'm sure you saw the ex-pope, the Nazi pope, Pope Benedict, came out of retirement. And yeah. Pope Francis was there. And they were canonizing mm-hmm. two previous popes. I think it was Paul the 23rd and John Paul the 2nd. They both became saints. Yeah. So there's been a lot of celebration around the world, particularly in places like Italy, where John Paul the 2nd is from, about him becoming a saint. A giant statue had been put up in the town of Sivo. It weighed over 1,320 pounds. Unfortunately, at a ceremony for the statue, it collapsed, landed on, and killed a man.
Oh, come on, Pope.
Where's your Messiah now?
Come on, Popey. That's no way to roll.
What do you say about God now if a statue of John Paul II falls off its perch into a crowd and kills someone? Is that God's will?
And if he needed a miracle ever, that would have been the time to pull one out of your ass, you know, Popey? You know, to bring that guy back to life after they pulled the statue over. Then, you, for sure, you deserve the sainthood.
Exactly. The statue needs to jump back up and go, my bad.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all good now. Here's a crazy story. The death itself happened on October 28th, 2012, but it is back in the news now. On a dark road in Canada, just outside Toronto, three bicyclists, teenage bicyclists, 16 and 17-year-olds, were in the road. A woman was speeding and on her cell phone and hit the bicyclist, killing one of the children. A 17-year-old named Brandon Majewski was killed. What's happening now that brings this story back in the news? The woman who hit and killed the bicyclist is suing his family because the accident, Ralph, caused her great pain and suffering.
Oh, did it now?
It did now.
Because she's suffering because she killed somebody, but it's their
yes.
fault.
She was speeding. She was on a phone, but she also claims that they were incompetent bicyclists and they should have been paying more attention and not been in the road.
Oh,
so
man.
She is suing the family of the teenager that she killed for great pain and suffering. She's looking for $900,000 in damages. The attorney for the family, by the way, says in all of his years as a lawyer, he's never, ever seen anyone sue a child that they killed. It's beyond the pale. I can't imagine she's going to have much success with that lawsuit. It's hard to be sympathetic in that situation to her and not the family,
if
right?
If she loses the case, the family should get 20 minutes with her and a ball-peen hammer.
I think
that's what
reasonable.
They should get. Just give me a room, lock the door, and let me just go at her with a tack hammer.
Hey, well, we're living in Ralph Graham and Frontier Justice. Things are going to be a whole lot different in this country. I'll
a lot
tell you
less
that.
Sloppy lawsuits, that's for sure.
And finally, and it pains me to have to do this in Death Quarter because I would have loved to have saved it for What's Up with Florida because it's two of our favorite things that are coming together. And this is another one that ended up in court. Apparently, a woman in Florida had something strange leaking down the walls of her house. It turned out that the deceased elderly woman upstairs, who had passed away from natural causes and lived alone with her dogs, her body went undiscovered for several weeks. A noxious odor began to fill the adjacent units. Neighbors complained. Maintenance workers entered the apartment, found that the dogs had eaten her remains. That's just normal business for Florida. But the undiscovered body went through its normal decaying process and eventually bloated to the point that the gases inside the corpse build off enough pressure that it caused the abdomen to burst. The released gases and fluids is what leaked down into the woman's apartment.
No! Come on, Bean!
Her name is Judy Rodrigo. The reason it is in the news today is because she sued State Farm, her insurer, as she was looking for reimbursement for repairs to clean up the goop that flowed into her unit. She gutted her apartment. Even then, afterwards, she claimed the odor lingered. The decision has been rendered, and State Farm is not on the hook. They do not have to pay because her apartment was covered for explosions and explosion, it was ruled in court, does not include a decomposing body's cells explosively expanding, causing a leakage of bodily fluids. That's not the kind of explosion that State Farm says that they are on the hook for if it happens in your apartment.
Yeah. Move. don't try to fix the smelly, goopy, dead body apartment. Just move.
And if we can offer some further advice, when you move, go ahead and get a unit on the top floor. That's what you ought to do. And that's today's all-new Beans Death Corner.
That was Beans Death Corner.
Oh, Bean loves death. Oh, Bean loves death.
Oh, Bean loves death so much.
Another email from a grateful Kevin and Bean listener, Marie, writes in. Thanks for the lovely breakfast story about a woman's intestines bloating, yes, bursting, and running down the walls. Yes. Yum.
Right, exactly.
Who's hungry?
Have you no filter, no sense of propriety whatsoever?
Dude, I don't write the news, okay? I'm just reporting it. That's all. Don't blame the messenger here. It's Bean's Death Corner. How can I not talk about death?
You don't have to talk about the goop running down walls. You can draw the line somewhere, can't you?
It happened. I'm nauseous. Happened in Florida.
I know.
Arcade Fire tickets in row number 2. August 1st or 2nd at the Forum. We got them for you at this hour here on the Kevin and Bean Show. And if I may just make a small programming note. This time tomorrow, we're going to be talking to Jonah Becker. You don't know the name, but he is the director of a documentary about the Penis Museum in Iceland.
Oh, yeah.
That's not fascinating enough. Which, yes, Kevin?
Which Bean has been to.
Yes.
Kids, stop clapping.
The point is, a fascinating documentary, especially when you see that there are men who are competing to donate their penises to the museum while they're still alive. So that's the crazy story he's going to be telling us this time tomorrow on the Kevin and Bean Show on K-Rock.
Like, every animal penis is there in the museum, but they do not have a human one. And
well, that's a huge hole in their collection.
That's not how it works,
that's what
Lisa.
He said. And, yeah, and so two people are trying to become the first one. They're both competing. It's the strangest thing ever. All right, let's talk about people who are afraid of flying. Because sometimes it's a ridiculous fear, but you can't really help it. You can't help what you're afraid of.
I don't think people are afraid of flying as much as they're afraid of crashing.
Of dying, sure. Yeah, I mean, that's the point, but it's so safe. I mean, really, billions of people do it and don't crash.
Right up until you're the one who does.
Right up until you're the one who does.
Tell that to Malaysia 370, Kevin.
Good point.
So we want to take your calls about the scariest flight you have ever been on. Something happened with the mechanics of the plane and you guys thought you were going to crash, or you lost a lot of altitude, or you had something crazy going on in the cabin or in the cockpit that caused chaos and caused people screaming and caused you seriously to think the plane was in trouble. Those are the stories that we're looking for right now. I don't think we've ever taken these calls before. I'm fascinated to hear the stories that people have had.
I remember, you know how when it's hot, it gets real shaky on the landing and takeoff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I remember that the plane was banking left and right and left and right when we were landing in Phoenix. And this is you know, my skills.
Phoenix is always bad.
My English skill, not being up to the level of a four-year-old. The wing, the left wing, it looked to me like it was going to hit the runway. It was tilted to the left enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I yelled, "Hey!"
That was your way of alerting the captain that he was...
I thought maybe the captain would wake up and realize... I don't know. I really, honestly, afterwards, I thought, why did I yell, "Hey?" Like, does that help?
What were the other passengers doing as they saw that the plane was lilting like
they
that?
They were holding on for dear life because it was really moving left, right, hard.
That's
and
scary.
You were worried about the angle at which you were coming in on the runway and you might actually crash.
But he landed it fine. It would have been bad if I distracted him and we crashed, though, by yelling, "Hey."
Was that the closest you ever came to, you feel like, being on a plane that crashed?
Yeah, I was pretty sure it was going to. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know why. Just, "Hey."
Let me,
that's an odd response.
Let me give out the phone number if you want to call. Tell us the scariest flight you were ever on. What happened and how certain were you that you were going to die at 1-800-520-1067. Remember the scene in, Almost Famous?
Oh,
where
sure.
They hit all that turbulence and they all thought they were going to die and the drummer yells out, "I'm gay!" Because he had to get it off his chest before he died. And then 5 seconds later, the turbulence just smoothed out. Everybody's just sitting there looking at him.
I'm going to need that clip, Mugs.
Okay. Spoiler alert, by the way. If you haven't seen Almost Famous yet, it's an awesome Cameron Crowe movie. Beer Mug, it didn't happen to you, but it happened to a loved one. What happened?
Well, Nicole Alvarez, who's deathly afraid of flying as it is already, on landing, takeoff, she does...
She travels all the time.
She travels all the time. You know, the weird thing is she also skydives, which...
What?
So,
well, this is no longer making sense.
Well, I know. It makes no sense. So she was on a flight, I think, to Miami, and she was by herself sitting next to a stranger. She took a nap, and she wakes up to this guy tapping on her in the seat next to her and telling her...
On her arm?
On her arm.
Yeah.
Hopefully it was on her arm.
Yeah.
Saying, you need to put your oxygen mask on. All the oxygen masks had fallen from the ceiling.
No.
You know, the put yours on before you put the children on.
How was she still asleep? Was there a giant... was there a giant drop in altitude or did...
No, the cabin just lost pressure.
Oh, I see.
It lost cabin pressure, so she's freaking out. And, yeah, everybody had to put their masks on. And I've never been on a plane where all the oxygen masks are. So that would that wouldn't help matter. So that cemented her fear of flying more.
And that's why she only now flies 4 days a week instead of seven.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
All right, before we go to your calls, and Erica, we're going to get to you first up, so please hang on at 1-800-520-1067. Listen to this news report of a story that just happened last week. Talk about a scary flight for these people.
An unruly passenger pulled off a Sacramento-bound plane after causing a disturbance in the air.
That plane leaving Chicago for Sacramento had to make an emergency landing in Nebraska after a person tried opening the back hatch of the aircraft. The person who tried opening the hatch was acting strangely before the incident ever took place. Well, the man was getting up, sitting down, he got up again, and that's when he tried opening the back hatch. And one of those passengers took matters into his own hand. He actually took that man down and held him on the ground until the pilot made an emergency landing in Omaha. Once on the ground, police and TSA agents took that man off the plane in handcuffs.
Dude tried to open the back door.
Oh, my God.
Which you can't do on a plane that's moving, right?
I don't know.
A passenger cannot open up.
Probably not.
I think the pilot has to release the hatch.
I don't want passenger trying, is my point.
Well, so many people on the plane were upset that some were fainting, many were nauseated, many were crying. So that must have been a terrifying thing. Even if the guy couldn't really do any harm, the fact that you've got a crazy person yelling and who has to be restrained in the aisle, I mean, that's upsetting when you're flying. Look, post 9/11, nobody ever wants to see passengers getting up to hold another dude down on a plane, right? All right, let's go to Erica real quick. 1-800-520-1067. Scariest flight you were ever on. Thank you for calling. Thank you for holding. What's going on, Erica?
No problem. Good morning, guys.
Hi.
I was 13, and I was on my first flight visiting family to Hungary all by myself, and we were flying over the Hudson Bay in Canada. When the pilot gets on, we were halfway over, and he goes, we've been leaking fuel. Don't quite know how much we have left. We're going to turn this plane around and see where we can get you guys landed. Everyone is screaming, and the plane is just doing these really weird mechanical things. We end up getting to Manitoba, Canada, like where everyone goes to see the polar bears, and we're circling around a deserted runway. People are screaming. The captain said, all right, get your head between your legs. Get ready. We're going to try to land this plane, and we barely made it. Ended up landing. It was one of the most frightening things.
Wow.
It was. Yeah,
That's legitimate terror there, though, Erica. You were allowed to be frightened by the plane, the pilot coming on and saying, we don't know if we have enough fuel to make it somewhere to land.
Yeah, and I had to call my parents at 3 in the morning in Canada saying, hey, I'm in Canada. So I think they were kind of freaked out because I was alone. But I fly for a living now.
What?
I'm in sales, so I definitely take my Xanax before I get on a plane.
No kidding. Thank you very much for the call, my dear. We appreciate it. Wow. I know people can't help it, but all the other passengers on the plane screaming doesn't help make the situation less stress-free.
No, not at all.
Not at all. So stop it.
So don't do that.
All right. Cameron, Kyle, Vanessa, Monica, you guys hang on. We'll take your calls next on the Kevin and Bean Show on K-Rock. We're having some fun now, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
Talking about the terror-filled skies of air travel. Talking about the scariest flight you were ever on. That guy who was held down by other passengers trying to open the rear door of the airplane while it's in flight on a flight last week from Chicago to Sacramento. By the way, a frequent Kevin Bean listener and contributor Omar writes in, hey, what about that one lady you talked about who kept screaming, God is my savior, God is my savior, God is my savior? Remember she was convinced the plane was going down?
Yeah, and she was screaming that for, what did he say, 45 minutes?
Yes, she was just praying out loud, which can't make the other people on the plane feel good.
I think I actually have... So that's you're my savior, and then she goes into it.
God, you're my savior! God, you're my savior! God, you're my savior! God, you're my savior!
She's been freaking out for the last 20 minutes. She started off by telling everyone to pray for her mother who just passed away. Then she went up and down the aisles telling everyone to pray for her mother.
That is not what you want.
That's not a good flight. That's not good.
That's a bad flight.
Hey, speaking of bad flights, give me my man Kyle, please. He's on line 3. We're taking your calls at 1-800-520-1067. Scariest flight you were ever on. Kyle, you're on.
Good morning, Kevin and Bean. It's me. How are you guys?
Good morning.
Hi, good.
Hey, so I was on a flight, and about 5 minutes in, we drop out of the sky and bank so hard to the left that as I look out the window, I can see the ground straight below us.
Oh, man.
Wow.
The pilot corrects the plane, gets back on the intercom 5 minutes later, and says, I apologize, but we were set on the same flight path as another plane and almost came up and hit the bottom of the plane above us.
Oh, my God.
So when you're making all those kind of evasive moves and everything like that, what does that do to all the passengers who are being thrown around on the plane?
luckily, it was so early, we were all still buckled in, but everyone was still rocking and rolling pretty good. Everyone was so nervous for the rest of the flight. No one slept, and my brother threw up everywhere.
Oh, we know what throwing up is, Kevin. We don't need to sound like that. All right, good times. Thanks so much for the call. Let's go to line 8. Let's talk to Phil. You talk about scary flights. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the Kevin and Bean Show.
Hey, good morning, guys. Lisa May.
Good morning.
Well, what happened?
So I was on a flight from L.A. to San Jose about a year ago, and literally less than 30 seconds before landing, the pilot just guns the throttle, tosses you back into the seat, and we start climbing aggressively away from the airport. And I'd been on a few flights where that's happened in the past where, you know, you don't line up for the runway correctly or they get a gust of wind. So no one's really panicking at this point, and I'm sitting in the fourth row on the aisle, and all of a sudden the flight attendant comes racing past me, the cockpit door swings open, and she jumps past the pilot into his seat, and he comes racing out of the cockpit down the aisle towards the back of the plane.
What? Where was he going?
So he went to, I think it was roughly the center of the plane, and started pulling people out of the emergency exit row and pulling up pieces of the carpet to check to confirm that our landing gear was down.
Why? What?
And how did the flight... What? The flight attendant moved into the pilot seat.
Yeah.
That seems like the worst part of it.
I guess you need to have somebody up there to...
Well, of course.
You know, well, wasn't there a co-pilot? But, well, couldn't the co-pilot get in the pilot seat and then she would get in his...
No, I don't know.
Did you run out of breath for that?
I totally
you literally didn't have enough breath to finish.
That is so. Obviously, you're on the phone talking to me now, so it probably landed fine. Everybody was okay.
Yeah, we did. There were fire trucks and emergency vehicles waiting, and I was one of the first ones off the plane. And I kind of do the, you know, you peek your head in the cockpit and just kind of see what was going on, and gave kind of a nod to the co-pilot, and he just looked straight past me. And with both hands, wiped the sweat off of his face.
Oh, my God.
Totally white.
That's fantastic.
His poor shirt was just soaked all the way through.
And by fantastic, you mean scary as hell.
Yeah, scary as hell. Thank you so much, Phil, for the call. I know we're running late. Let's talk to Monica real quick on line 5, just because, Kevin, you haven't brought this up yet, but your plan has always been, in the event of a plane going down, you're going to try to find the hottest chick on board and see if you guys can have sex one last time before you die.
Yeah, if it's over, I'm going to try and play that card.
Absolutely. Look, we only have 5 minutes to live. Let's go out with a bang.
We can do it twice.
Monica, you were in a similar situation. What happened on your flight?
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Lisa. Yeah, I was on my way back from Vegas to Ontario. All kinds of turbulence. Grown men screaming and yelping. And one of the guys that I thought was cute early on in the flight was actually had his head between his knees, gripping the chair in front of him, screaming, and indentations actually in the seat.
Really?
Oh my gosh.
Not so cute then.
And then, no. And the ladies next to me that were sitting next to me, it's probably like a mom and a daughter, closed their eyes, praying, what I can only assume was praying, just crazy praying very quickly. I actually leaned over towards them because I thought if anybody's going to get saved in this plane, it's probably going to be them, so I'm going to try to get in on that action.
Sure. Now, did you think about, hey, I have 20 minutes to live, maybe that cute guy and I can get something going?
No, I was just happy that it happened on the way back from Vegas and I at least had the weekend. And it's
That's a good way to look at it.
Right.
So, that's cool, a good way to
glass
look at
half
it.
Full. Nicely done.
Thank you, Monica. Kevin, I found your partner in crime.
All right.
I found your broadcasting brother.
Oh, right.
You know how Kevin is not bound by traditional rules of pronunciation when it comes to words?
Yes. Yes, I do.
He doesn't get all uptight about saying the letters in the right order, especially when it comes to, you know, names like Leonardo DiCaprio and Farrah Abramson and names like that. He just is, you know, whatever he feels, he goes with. And that's on us to, you know, to accept or decipher or move on. But Kevin's very comfortable with that. And he is often asked, how am I still on the radio? How was I hired to be a professional broadcaster on a real radio station in a big city?
Yeah.
I'm going to say to you, you're fine.
All right.
Al Sharpton is the guy we ought to be asking this question about.
Really?
He has a TV show on MSNBC, And you've never seen a guy who has more trouble reading a teleprompter and pronouncing people's names than Al Sharpton. There are a couple of supercuts up of Al and his failures. And I'm going to play one of them for you, and we'll go through and we'll try to figure out some of the things that he's saying. And sometimes it's just, you know, there are words on the screen, and he just reads different words. Like in this one, he's talking about recalling something, and he says resisting it.
But resist we much.
Instead of we must. Right, exactly. So sometimes he's reading that. Sometimes he does see the word on the screen. He just doesn't know how to pronounce it, like when he tries to pronounce the word giddy.
They're all jitty about a shutdown.
What? They're jitty, you guys, about the shutdown.
The tortoise.
That's a tortoise, Reverend. Tortoise, sorry, sure. It's not really a tortoise.
Then co-author of Hubris.
Hubris is hubris.
Hubris,
the name of the book he's going for there.
You two lead singer Bono.
Well, I think we all know.
It is Bono.
I think we all know it's more likely to be Bono.
Sigourney Weaver.
How about Sigourney?
Sigourney Weaver?
Am I lying, or is he challenging Kevin for the crown?
This is the best.
Dad?
How did we not know this?
Is now, he my dad?
He really has trouble consistently saying the very difficult name Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh, one of the most famous people in America. For some reason, Reverend Al isn't quite sure how that name goes.
Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh.
Good old Rush Limbaugh.
Bug or Bob?
I think it's Bog.
The show Rush Lombard hosts Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
All right, that's close. Sotomayor is close, right?
I don't know. What is it?
Michael
Sotomayor.
Oh, so okay.
I think he's got trouble with another Supreme Court justice here in a minute.
Is Mike Muckery.
Okay. Now, that's McQuarrie. Remember that assistant coach?
Wow.
Yesterday, Antonin Scalia.
Antonin Scalia, right?
Kim Kardashian.
Come on.
I'm fine with that. That's the only one I'm happy with.
But seriously, do you live in the world or do you not live in the world?
I mean, he is a political show and he can't say the name of the Supreme Court justices.
Yes. Latvia, I believe, is the country he's talking about.
We rank behind Latvia, Lavita.
Loca. Lavita Loca. That's where it is going for.
Anyone ever been to Chipotle? Very popular restaurant, Chipotle.
All the time.
He's getting lunch at Chipotle.
Almost sound like Chevrolet.
He's going to Chipotle.
Wow.
A couple more from Reverend Al.
Why was traffic problems email sent?
That is a perfect
Kevin
example, by the way.
Wait,
that is a
that
Kevinism.
Again.
Is that great?
Why was traffic problems email sent?
Ladies and gentlemen, the great Reverend Al Sharpton.
I love him.
The creepiest sex toy you'll ever hear about coming up in about 10 minutes or so right here on the Kevin and Bean Show for a Tuesday morning on K-Rock. Thanks so much for tuning in. Lisa Mann, we got an update on a story we brought you last week about the Queen, at least someone tweeting on behalf of the Queen at the British Monarchy Twitter account, that the Queen was going to be visiting Belfast in Ireland and visiting the set of the Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm. I remember.
We all were a little bit suspicious that the Queen is actually a fan of Game of Thrones.
We don't believe it at all.
I mean, is it possible that an 88-year-old woman and her 93-year-old husband are watching Game of Thrones every Sunday?
With all the boobs and the nudity and the death and no, it's not possible.
It doesn't seem like it's possible. I bet you'd be hard-pressed to find very many 90-year-olds in general who are watching Game of Thrones.
Yes.
So the suspicion was that maybe this was just some younger person in the social media department of the Windsor family who was trying to hip up the Queen a little. They're trying to make, hey, the people are into the Game of Thrones. Let's make the Queen into the Game of Thrones. That was our suspicion. Well, now it's happened. Now they have been to Belfast, and I am looking at photographs of the Queen standing in front of the Iron Throne right now.
Okay.
There she is with Prince Philip. She met some of the actors from the show, met the creators of the show. It's not clear here in this article whether she asked any questions or how much she knew about the Game of Thrones, but they did, in fact, actually go there. And whether she was forced into it for a photo op, I don't know. But we wanted to find out more about what's real and what's not in this British Monarchy Twitter account. So we asked Dave, hey, could you line us up somebody? And believe it or not, we have a spokesperson for the Queen. The personal secretary to the Queen is Lord Basil Nicholls Smythe, and he joins us on the Kevin and Bean Show right now. Hello, Lord. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. And I apologize. I called you Lord. Is that appropriate for your title?
Yes, that's quite appropriate. Thank you so much.
All right. So you might have heard before we went to you on the phone, sir, that we were suspicious that Her Majesty perhaps really doesn't watch this TV show. This was all just a photo op. Can you comment?
May I say, in all candor, how dare you, sir?
Okay.
In another place, another time, you and I would be meeting on the field of battle and engaging in a duel.
Well, I'm not interested in anything like that. Just trying to get some facts here, sir.
Well, I don't appreciate you casting disparaging remarks upon my veracity regarding the Queen's Twitter account.
She's 88 years old. She's not watching Game of Thrones.
She is most certainly watching Game of Thrones. It's a favorite television program ever since Breaking Bad went off the air.
See, again, I think this is just something you're saying to make the Queen sound like she's of the people.
That's not the case at all. She is a huge Breaking Bad fan. It brought back memories of her own days slinging meth in the East End.
All right, she's been queen for like 65 years. She never had a slinging meth in the East End phase.
Well, she did go through a period where she was quite the meth addict, and so in order to support her habits, she would go selling it as well. Now, of course, she's simply on the scissor-up.
Okay, again, I just think you're making stuff up to make her sound hip. None of this is happening,
it
sir.
It absolutely is happening, and if she was here herself, she would tell you, but unfortunately she's out now. She had to go to the CD store to pick up the new Deadmau5 album.
Okay.
No.
The Queen is not raving. She's just not. You're telling lies.
If she was here herself, she would tell you that she's a huge Deadmau5 fan. And of course, I can only speak on her behalf, but I know she loves to drop some E and really enjoys the EDM music.
Okay, we're talking about Queen Elizabeth II, the yes. ruler of Great Britain,
indeed,
right?
Indeed, yes. And, oh, the Royal Majesty is back. Hold on. I have to see what she wants. Okay. Yes, Your Majesty. Oh, yes, one moment. She's just reminding me to get her prepared. Her MMA trainer is coming. So
okay.
She has to get in shape for a fight. And Dana White has been calling regarding her participating in the UFC.
Okay, you don't have to lie. The Queen is a nice lady. People already like her. You don't have to make stuff up.
I'm not making this up at all. She's been a little backlogged with all the travel, and she's missing out on some training. And she wants to catch up, having spent her time, of course, at Bonnaroo.
She wasn't at Bonnaroo. Look,
she was leading the F. Kanye chapter, you know.
The Queen does not know who Kanye West is. She was not in Tennessee for a concert.
She does know. She wasn't said F. Kanye quite vociferously at the top of her lungs. Yes, Your Majesty. No, I haven't forgotten, no. No, 12 o'clock. Yes, we're just setting up her twerking session. She has to get her twerking in every day, or else she gets quite cranky.
All right. Well, listen.
Oh, yes. Oh, no. No, we'll play Call of Duty in a little bit. She's so eager to play those video games. Can't get enough of that in Grand Theft Auto.
All right. Lord Nicholsmite.
Yes,
okay.
Yes. All right, no, I'll tend to it in a second. I'm sorry, I must be going. It's time for her Brazilian wax and her vajazzling.
No!
Well, we don't usually have boy bands on the Kevin and Bean Show, but when we do, we try to make it someone from the Beatles. Our next guest, followed being one of the most beloved rock groups of all time to carve out not just a phenomenal solo career, but he's in the Guinness Book of World Records as the world's most successful musician and songwriter, too. He is the one and only, the legendary Sir Paul McCartney. He joins us on the Kevin and Bean Show right now. Hi, Paul.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Very good. We're doing great, and what an honor it is to talk to you. Now, do we have to call you sir, or is that just a thing in your country?
King Paul.
King, all right. You talk to a lot of people. Is it awkward for you how wigged out people get when they meet you or when they have the chance to interview you?
Well, you know, I mean, it's a little bit weird, but I try and put people at ease. You know, at first people are a little bit, oh, my God, you know, but then it's like, oh, come on, guys, you know, and they see I'm pretty normal. So it cools down after a couple of seconds.
Dodger Stadium, Sunday, August 10th. Tickets on sale now. You last played the stadium 48 years ago this summer, Paul.
I know. It couldn't have been me.
Those early stadium shows, and I think the Beatles were the first of the rock bands to play the stadium shows, they were really, really tough for you guys to do, right?
Well, I mean, the thing is, you know, nowadays you've got a big sound system, and so at least you can be heard. You can hear yourself,
and the people in the crowd can hear you, no matter what's going on. Then you had lousy little systems that we didn't know they were lousy. It was the state of the art at the time. But when a lot of girls would scream, you couldn't hear anything, you know. And so, yeah, it became a little tough for us because, you know, after all, we were musicians. And it wasn't just kind of pure pop to us. You know, we thought we were actually making music. So it got on our nerves a bit, you know. In the end, it was like, well, what are we doing, you know. So we just decided we'd just go in the studio and we'd make records. And we'd let the records do the touring.
Sure. Well, what about now with stage shows and ways to fill up, you know, you got video screens and laser shows and all that kind of stuff?
Well, I mean, I love it. You know, it's, I mean, the joke is, you know, I say to people, take a guess. How long did the Beatles play when they came on stage? And people make guesses, you know. Nobody gets it. I mean, we did about half an hour.
And now you're doing six times that every night.
That was what people did those days, man. If you think about it, you know, it's like, you know, if you'd be auditioning a comedian, you'd say, well, how long do you do? He'd say, oh, 4 minutes. You know, he'd say, okay, that's good. So kind of off the back of that, it was like with us, it was like 30 minutes was quite a, seemed quite like quite a long time, you know.
Okay,
and but as I shared it with, like, John and George and Ringo on the vocals, I think I must have exactly done about, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes myself.
That is barely a day's work, Paul. You should feel guilty for taking the money back then.
No way.
But what about, let's talk about it and put it in contemporary context, because even among people who are touring, and there are very few artists that can play the stadiums in 2014, you're certainly one of them, you're still putting on more of a show than anyone. At your age, this is an honest question. How do you do 3 hours in the middle of summer in a stadium? How do you rock that hard for that long?
You know, it's one of those things I ask myself, you know, because it is like, surely, I mean, okay, the physical thing, but then again, I've just got to get bored after all these years. But I'm not. I love it. The audiences are fantastic. They really give you the vibe. I love what I do. I've got a lot of good songs, you know, because I can choose from the Beatles period or the Wings period or more recently solo stuff or even the new album, you know, and it works. So, you know, when I get in front of an audience, I might even be thinking, oh, no, here we go again. But the minute I get in front of the audience and start doing the show, it goes by like, you know, really quickly, you know, and I suddenly find myself on the last number and going, what happened, you know? So I just love it. I love to do it. People say, you must get really tired, you know, that's a long set. I say, no, with the audience, between the audience and the choice of songs and stuff, something happens, and it's like energizing. It's not tiring at all.
We are talking to Paul McCartney here on the Kevin and Bean Show. He is playing Sunday, August 10th at Dodger Stadium. Got a big tour going all across the country this summer. The final show at Candlestick Park ever before they tear it down is going to be a few nights later on August the 14th. So that's of interest to our listeners as well. You know, since you're going to be in L.A. and you have so many friends here, including your friend Dave Grohl, do you think there's any possibility some other people may join you on the Dodger Stadium date, Paul?
Well, there's always a possibility. You know, it depends who's in town, who fancies showing up. But you're right. You know, that's one of the great things about L.A. Is that nowadays I have millions of people I know out there. You know, I mean, not least of all Ringo. So who knows? We might find a couple of them creeping up on stage unbeknownst to me.
Do you mind talking to us, since Dave Grohl is such a big artist on our station with Foo Fighters, Paul, a little bit about what that relationship is like with him? You guys seem to have such an easy musical chemistry in the Sound City documentary where you guys wrote and recorded that song that you ended up winning a Grammy for, but it just seems like you're almost musical blood brothers, you two.
Well, you know, the thing about Dave is, as you know, he's such an enthusiast. I mean, he's a live wire, you know. So anything you do with him is up. Kind of thing, you know, as you know, if he's big on your station, you interviewed him
many times.
He's a very up guy, you know, so it's very infectious. And I'm a great enthusiast too, you know. So when he asked me to come along and, you know, maybe do some music for the Sound City thing, I just thought, well, okay, you know, we'll see what happens. And I got there, and he said, well, what are we going to do? You know, should we do an old rock and roll song or something?
And he made a couple of suggestions, and I said, no, you know, I've done that, you know. And a couple of ones he mentioned I'd done with the Beatles. So I said, well, you know, I've done those with the Beatles, and I don't want to try and top those. And I'd just been given a new guitar by Johnny Depp, actually. It was that little cigar box thing. And I was so in love with it. I said, look, let me just sort of wail around on this and see what happens. I started kicking around on that. And started screaming a bit of vocal kind of thing. And Dave jumped in on drums. And so there was no way there wasn't going to be any chemistry. And then the two other guys, Chris and Pat, started playing alongside us. And so we suddenly had a big thing going, a big jam thing. And we listened to it. The first take, I think, was about 20 minutes or something. So we listened to it and thought, what are we going to do? Should we structure it a little bit? You know, so we agreed on what we were going to do, got back in there, made the song, and it was all over in about 3 hours. But all of us just had a complete blast. In the middle of all of that, I didn't even know I was at a Nirvana reunion. I thought I was just jamming with a bunch of guys. It was only when I started hearing them talking, they go, hey, we haven't done this for 20 years or something. I'm going, what are you talking about, guys? Well, you know, we're Nirvana. I must admit, I didn't even know, you know. So I said, oh, okay, well, that's pretty cool.
That is an amazing story, and it's such a great moment in the movie where Dave looks at you and he says, why can't it always be that easy? And you say back to him, it is. So I think you schooled him a little bit. We have to take a very quick break. More with our guest Paul McCartney in a moment here on the Kevin and Bean Show on K-Rock. The show is at Dodger Stadium. It's the must-see show of the summer, Sunday, August 10th. Tickets on sale right now through tickets.com. We'll be right back. And we are back on the Kevin and Bean Show. Sir Paul McCartney. I know it sounds like a joke. It's not a guy doing a voice in the other room. It's actually the real Paul McCartney on the phone right now talking about Dodger Stadium, Sunday, August the 10th. Tickets are on sale now. You mentioned earlier, Paul, that you have so many songs to choose from. Are you sifting through set lists right now and maybe looking for some things you haven't played in the past on tour?
Yeah, I'm always doing that. You know, the thing about the set at the moment is it's working really well. You know, I was saying to you about when I get on there and start doing it, the set flows very well. And there's a good pacing to it. So for me and for the audience, it just works, you know. And I kind of look at the set list and think, okay, what's coming up next? You know, at the end of the number, I think, what's coming up next? Oh, yeah, that'd be good. And then after that, I'm going, oh, yeah, okay, I quite fancy that. You know, I think it'll be pretty much the tour we've just been doing in South America, which is the Out There tour. And, but, you know, we're always looking for ways to freshen it. So there are a couple of new pieces that we're looking at that we'll probably have rehearsed up by then. So, yeah, there'll be a few little surprises, I imagine.
Is it a difficult process to come up with that kind of list? I mean, you have so many songs.
Well, yeah, there is a bit of that, yeah, I'll tell you the truth, because I think, you know, we would have to do like 10 hours probably to stick it all in. But, yeah, you know, what happens is, you know, you try songs in rehearsal and then you put them in the set. But to get in the set, they've got to be songs you love doing in rehearsal. You know, some of them we try and I just go, you know what, I'm just not feeling this one. It's a nice song, but I'm not enjoying playing it live. So it takes something to actually make the team, as it were, you know. And then it's to do with pacing. You find that, you know, just at this point in the set where I'm getting a bit knackered and I'm just thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, I wish I could sit down. I suddenly get a bit where I go on the piano and I get to sit down.
Ah.
So it's like, aha, I wish I could stand up. Oh, okay, cool.
If only I were in charge of that.
Do that then. So, you know, it's pretty well paced at the moment. It's one of the things I like about the show.
Paul, there's been so much talk of the Beatles, particularly this year with the 50th year anniversary of you guys coming to America. Do you enjoy that nostalgia looking back to those early days? Or in your mind, sometimes do you think, hey, we broke up in 1970, quit talking about it?
Yeah, no, it's I do enjoy it. It's like kind of talking about your college days, you know, when you kind of not at college anymore, and there's quite a few years gone by, and you're just talking about, oh, man, remember that? We did that. And obviously with the Beatles, so much that we did was incredible. And, you know, I can talk like that now because it's over, you know. So I'm looking back on it. It's like looking at a scrapbook, you know. I'm going, whoa, you know, think about that, man. I remember that time when we went on, and we were on the beach, or we went down to Miami and we were water skiing. And oh, what about that gig, man? You couldn't hear a thing, you know. And then we played on the Ed Sullivan Show, and, you know, we didn't even know how big his show was till someone told us. So there's so many great little moments like that I actually like to be reminded of them. So people do sometimes think, oh, no, you know, I don't want to bore you, you know, I want to ask you a Beatles question. I say, no, it's okay, you know. You can be at a dinner party and stuff, and everyone's telling their stories, and I'm kind of just sort of thinking, you know, it'd be good if they asked me a Beatle question.
Well, I have, as we prepare to let
stories,
as we prepare to let you go, Mr. McCarty, I do have one question that I've always wanted to hear from your own mouth, because I've heard several versions of the story, and it goes back to 1976. You and your good friend John Lennon are in the Dakota apartment building in New York watching Saturday Night Live. Can you tell us, for the record, please, what really did and did not happen that night?
Yeah, sure, yeah. I'd come over, and I was visiting New York, and I went over to see John. And we're just sitting around, and we're just having a laugh and just talking about this and that, you know. And Saturday Night Live came on, and he said, oh, have you been watching this? I said, no, I'm living in England. I haven't been watching. I said, why? What's going on? He said, oh, they've got this amazing thing going on where Lorne Michaels, the producer, came on last week. And he said, I'm entitled to offer you, the Beatles, you know, so much money. It was like, I forget, it was like $100.
It was $3,000 or something, wasn't it?
It wasn't an awful lot, yeah. But it was rate, you know, it was the standard rate. Apparently Lorne had really been into the office of the NBC guy. And the guy had said, well, we can offer them this much as a standard rate. So John said, you know, he said, it's a hoot, you know. He said, you know, it would be great. He said, we should go down there now. And the both of us thought for a second. We said, what? He said, it's only around the corner. He said, like, we should just go down. And we just show up. He said, it'd be great, you know. We went, yeah. So for about 5 minutes, we were going, we've got to do it. Come on, let's do it. And then it was like, are you kidding? It was like, no. Let's just stay in and watch the show and just, you know, stay comfortable. If we go down there, it's going to be crazy. So it'll be a great story. But, you know, it's your Saturday night off, and here we go putting it on, you know. So we decided against it, you know, and just had a laugh with the thought of it all.
Well, I think it was probably one of the...
It happened, man. It very, very nearly happened.
That is amazing. And don't you think it was one of the smartest decisions the Beatles ever made to not get back together again?
Yeah, I do, actually. I mean, it was very conscious, you know, because we talked about it. We certainly got offered a lot of money to do it. But it was one of those things. We said, you know what, guys? We've done it. We've come full circle. We've been through all the sort of joys and the horrors of being in a band. We've done everything we wanted to do. And, you know, if we now sort of get back together again, it could fall flat. We might not enjoy it. You know, so why do it? You know, so it was one of those, we said, you know, just as we say in England, like, leave them laughing.
Right.
You know, it's just like, we've done it. We've proved all we have to prove. Let's just leave it there. And we stuck with that decision, even though once or twice, you know, it was quite tempting because people would say, look, I give you this, you know. And so we got some very tempting offers.
Well, it's amazing. The Beatles is one band that will never die. It gets rediscovered by new generations every year. I mean, the Beatles' one album was the best-selling album of the 21st century so far. I mean, it's astonishing.
I mean, you better believe, you know, you're wondering about it. But for me, it's freakish, you know. It's like, wow. I can't believe it. You know, I look at the people in our audience, and we've got kids, you know. We've got kids younger than some of my kids. You know, you've got like kind of 10-year-old kids and stuff and younger. And then you come up to the next sort of generation, which are like the 20-year-olds. Some of those are dangerously babe-like. And then you get into the kind of 30-year-olds, the 40-year-olds, and it kind of goes on. It comes right up to my generation. So it's amazing.
You have a daughter who's about 11 or 12, right? What does she think of the Beatles?
She loves them, you know.
What do you expect them to say?
The funny thing is, when they're that age, unless you've played it a lot to them, I mean, a lot of the ones who come to our concerts, their parents have really played them all the albums. I mean, like Dave Grohl, you know, he gave his kid all the vinyls, and so his kids know everything, you know. Mine, I've just sort of let it be, really. I haven't sort of bothered, I haven't pushed it. So she'll hear things, you know, that when she comes to a concert, she'll hear some stuff. But so she just got a few favorites, and the real ones that she sort of knows well, you know. But she doesn't know it as much as a lot of people do, because I haven't really pushed it with her, you know. I just let her find her own way with it.
Paul McCartney, Out There is the tour, Sunday, August 10th at Dodger Stadium. Do not sleep on this. Tickets available right now through tickets.com, or you can win some right now if your caller is 10, 11, or 12 at 1-800-520-1067. Call the Kevin Amin Show right now. Win your way in to see the great Paul McCartney. I don't know if we'll ever have a chance to do this again, Sir Paul, but thank you so much for the time. It's a real honor to have you on the program today.
That's a really nice interview. So I hope to see you at the gig.
Absolutely, sir. Thanks for the call.
Let's make it a date.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
See you guys. Bye.
Oops. You hung up on Paul McCartney.
Well, he was saying goodbye.
Just for the record, I didn't hang up on Paul McCartney. That was Muggs.
Hey, I saw that it was Muggs. Of course it was Muggs.
Holmey writes in, listening to the interview, enjoying it very much until the end. And Kevin makes the Guinness Book of World Records as the only person to ever hang up on Paul McCartney.
Come on, he said goodbye like three different times, and I thought he was done.
Right, but what would it have hurt you to wait until you heard the click on his end of the phone rather than hang up on the man?
Muggs, what would that have hurt you?
How dare you?
I don't know, man. We got to get rid of him.
You're trying to blame your screw-up on Muggs so that we can fire Muggs?
Screw-up? Yes.
I'm fine with that.
Okay, good.
I'm fine with blaming it on Muggs. Absolutely.
Hey!
Nice. Well done, guys.
Thank you to Jack White for coming in. How awesome is that?
Boy, that was fun. Cool. Man, that was fun. And as we mentioned during the breakfast with, you can see the whole thing. It is streaming on KROQ.com right now and will for about another 23 hours or something like that if you want to watch the performance with Jack and his great, great band. And let me just throw this message out for people who are listening to the program via podcast around the world. We're not allowed to put the songs on the podcast, of course, because of music rights issues. But if you love Jack White like we do, go to the website, go to KROQ.com and watch it. And that way you can enjoy the songs in their full, glorious way.
All right, good tip.
All right.
Let's talk about lube.
All right.
Well, that's...
How could this thing get even better?
That's an abrupt transition, Kevin.
Here's the headline.
Hey, that Jack White was up. Let's talk about lube.
Here's the headline. Marijuana-infused sex lube is a real thing.
Is this good for me or bad for me?
For you, it's probably bad.
Probably bad.
Let me tell you what it says here.
I'm going to die!
It's called Floria, Lisa. Mm-hmm. And here's what the man behind it says. Women report a sense of embodiment, a sense of dropping into a more full relationship to sexual sensations and sensations around the body. As you can imagine, as that builds up to orgasm, if orgasm is part of your experience, then that can lead to intensification and a more full body experience. Now, I know from personal experience that women can't have orgasm, so this guy doesn't know what he's talking about.
Sure.
But they're saying that there's something in the marijuana. You know, we've heard about all these mysterious things that are in marijuana in THC, they're saying that it does make for a more intense orgasm. So,
or at least you're high if you don't.
Right, exactly, right.
Yeah, but don't you have to ingest it?
Well, let's find out, because we have too many questions
right,
about this.
That's my point.
But it is edible, Lisa, so I think there is some benefit to getting some of it in your mouth, too. But I don't want to guess.
All right, guys.
I don't want to guess. Let's go to entrepreneur Matthew Gerson, who joins us on the phone. He is the genius behind Floria. Matthew, welcome to the Kevin Amin Show, sir. How are you?
I'm well. How are you, sir?
Oh, we're good. We're doing fine, yeah. So congratulations on your Floria, I guess it's called. A lot of people are talking about it, and a lot of people have questions.
Yes, they do, and it's becoming very popular.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are really going to enjoy it.
Okay. What about sex made the light bulb go off over your head where you said, you know what sex needs is pot?
Well, you know, it wasn't so much about sex. It was about my girlfriend at the time who would only bone me when she was high.
Oh, I see.
So I figured this way, you know, that it would be more of an encouragement for her to have sex with me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If I was able to, you know, promise her getting high as well.
Sure.
I see. Okay. Yeah. So if you use this marijuana-infused oil, if you use that as a sexual lubricant, some of what's in the pot just gets absorbed into the, I guess, both people's bodies that come in contact with the skin, and they both get a little bit of a high if they have sex with it?
Well, not so much with the fellas, because, you know, the skin is not a permeable membrane for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. All right.
Sounds like you're not that familiar with how sex works.
I actually am not,
or,
no.
Or lady parts. But for a woman, sex often ends up being involved internally for a woman.
Okay, right. Okay.
And so the membranes of the vaginal area are able to absorb things through the vaginal area, through the membrane.
Okay, I got you.
And so
it, what are you laughing at, Kevin?
Kevin, be an adult.
You keep saying vaginal area.
Well, we're talking about it.
It's where the lady has sex sometimes.
Right, I know.
In the vaginal area.
I know, my bad.
So the THC contained therein actually is able to penetrate through the permeable membranes inside the vaginal area.
Vaginal area, right, yeah.
And she does enjoy a certain sense of euphoria as well as having, you know, heightened sexual experience.
Okay. So, Mr. Gerson, what's this going to cost me if I want to buy a bottle of Euphoria?
It's just a low, low price of $88 an ounce.
$88 an ounce?
Wow. How long does an ounce last me?
Well, it depends on how big your vaginal area is.
Well, for years then, obviously.
Some ladies can use an eyedropper. Some ladies need a paint roller.
Really? A paint roller?
Yeah, you get in there with a paint roller and a drop cloth, and you just coat the vaginal.
That is sexy.
I'm sorry, what are you saying?
That sounds like a lot of fun.
The vaginal area.
Right.
Just slather it on there, and then everyone's able to enjoy their time, you know, their intimate time.
Right. Okay.
And,
all right.
So as I mentioned, the cannabis contained within Euphoria is able to penetrate the permeable membranes. And then women have experienced all kinds of positive side effects from overall sexual enlightenment all the way through to full blown, you know, orgasms that have been, you know, greatly intensified by this.
Okay.
I find it hard to trust your opinion on sex. How long did you have that girlfriend?
We were dating for well over a week or two.
Oh. A week or two.
But my real passion is finding uses for hemp and for cannabis in everyday life to enhance our lives.
I see.
I have a lot of experimental experience in that area, and this is the most successful I've had. I have tried for the gentleman. There's been anal pot suppositories.
Oh no!
Yeah. I discovered.
Wait, can we no longer smoke it?
I discovered one time when I was pulled over by this cop.
Right.
And I had to spend some time in county jail, and I had to dispose of my stash at the time.
Right. Sure, think fast, yeah.
And I found that introducing the pot anally was also a successful way to really have a good time, so that was pretty good. I still contend, by the way, that was a racial profiling situation when he pulled me over.
Racial?
Yeah. I was driving a black VW bus at the time. I don't think he liked blacks. Or, you know, you can just do what I do, which is take some cannabis and just slather it all over my Dr. Scholl's insoles when I put my moccasins on, and I just absorb the pot right through the bottom of my feet.
Right. Maybe you need a little less pot.
So you want to buy some of this stuff? It's only $80 an ounce.
Seems like a lot.
Or I'll give you half an ounce for $40.
Yeah, right, that's here we
good.
Go.
That's good. I'll take that.
Coming up in about 10 minutes or so, we're going to talk to our friend Harvey Levin from TMZ.com, who is now part of the problem. He's no longer just reporting on the problem. He's now part of the problem, as he is making unknowns famous just on a whim. Just because he can, because he's the most powerful man in Hollywood. So we'll talk to him about famous in 12 on the way in just a few minutes. First, though, you guys brought up something on Friday that I know nothing about.
Oh, you're going to love it so much.
We wanted to save it for you because you rarely get a chance to enjoy something fresh here on the show.
Yeah, Bean saw it last, apparently. There's something that's going on with mugs that I don't know anything about. Tell me.
Bean Mugs Twitter War!
Yeah. You're about the Twitter warrior. We had no idea.
Who knew?
He's out there in the trenches throwing down with all kinds of people.
All right, well, now at least I know why I don't know anything about it, because like any respectable person, I don't follow Beer Mug on Twitter.
Right.
I think what happened is a listener tweeted Chip
And then she went to Twitter to try and find it, and Beer Monk had already deleted it. Yeah, and some listener
deleted all his tweets because he knew he was horrible.
Some listener like screen capped it or whatever and sent it back to her.
Once it's out there in the internet, it's not going away. God bless.
Beer Monk's Twitter war.
We were able to get a transcript of the Twitter war that went on between Muggs and one of our listeners.
Fantastic.
And he's horrible.
What happened? What was the beef about?
All right, this is what kicked it off. Beer Mug tweeted the following, which is my least favorite kind of tweet, because it's like, I've got a secret, and you're not going to know what it is, but I'm going to make you listen to it.
Right.
This is what he tweeted.
It's annoying.
You think you can trust people, then they S on your face behind your back. Just go with me on that.
Oh, my God. Muggs, do you remember what was going on when you tweeted that?
Yeah. I was having a bad day that day.
Really?
Yeah.
So you've got some problem with some person, and obviously you're not addressing it with them, but you're putting a tweet out there which gives no details to anything that you're really talking about, but you just need everyone to hear that you have some sort of problem with somebody.
Yeah, it was sort of a way for me to vent at the moment. It was not a good way.
You should have a friend or something.
Can I ask you for clarification on how somebody can S on your face behind your back?
Makes no sense.
That's talent. That's amazing.
Maybe if you've got your head between your legs far enough and it's literally behind your back. Back at that point, and then they come by. I don't know. It's physically impossible. So a listener, Al, God bless him, read that, and he wrote, file everything. File your life under F for fat. Which was funny.
Al wins.
That's Beer Mug's Twitter war!
Yeah, the war's over. Al dropped the big one, really, in tweet two.
And I don't have any idea what it must be like to be Beer Mug and live his life and see the response that he must get from our listeners, because they can be funny but cruel. But you have to look at that and go, well, this is a fan of the show who's just playing along. He's just making a joke about my thing. And you had to have laughed at that, Muggs.
I know. And usually,
No, he did not.
Not with the Twitter war.
That's what you would think.
Usually I do. And it was just a bad day. I was like Michael Douglas in the movie Falling Down. Uh-huh. It just spiraled out of control. Okay. I was just not in a good mood.
Right. Beer Mug's Twitter war!
What if Mug's right back?
Because I thought I could trust people, and then I put my head behind my back, and then someone asked on it.
So Mug's comes back with, and this is, I don't know, a couple days ago? Last week?
Yeah, the end of last week.
Sorry about the Sharks, buddy!
Apparently this guy was a Sharks fan, a San Jose Sharks fan.
Had you been going back and forth with this guy before? Is there history?
He was when the Kings were playing the Sharks.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. I say we, but I'm not part of the team. He was going, "Oh, you're down 0-3. Get your crying towels out." And I didn't respond. So,
but he had gotten under your skin.
Yeah,
yeah, okay.
So weeks later, your third tweet into your war, you're coming back with a slam against his team, who has been out of the playoffs for a month.
Well, yeah, just because he responded to my first tweet of...
Yeah, but it was the current tweet. It was a tweet you had just put out there. He was responding to that.
Yeah.
That was just happening. Yeah. You went back to the Sharks? You went back to that?
Yeah, I did.
For your death blow.
Sure.
Sorry about the Sharks, buddy. To which Al responds, sorry about your life, buddy.
Yes!
Boom! Al wins again.
Al wins again.
Yeah, I'm scoring at 2-0 Al right now.
Muggs comes back with, oh, no, you didn't!
To Al, oh... I did.
You did what? Massively choke like your hockey team?
Now, Muggs, at this point, blind anger.
I was in a pit of just obsessive compulsive, like, I'm not going to just take anything right now.
And once you put that out there, though, you went, that was kind of lame.
Everything I was putting out there was...
I'm not asking now, I'm saying then.
Yeah.
Then you thought, yeah.
Yeah.
At what point do you stop and say, I got nothing on this guy. I'm still going back to hockey games that were played a month ago.
I was blind with rage. Well,
sadly, Al wasn't.
Yeah.
Because he came back with, I can't wait till you massively choke on one of the 15 meals you eat every day. Tell your moms I said hi. I mean your roommate.
So I got it at 3-0.
3-0 Al. At this point, it's a blowout.
Beer Mug's Twitter war!
Which Mug responds with, someone sounds cranky.
I'd say the someone that sounds cranky is the person who said they S on your face behind your back.
Right. Someone who's all butthurt because someone hurt their feelings. That guy sounds cranky. Muggs came back again with another tweet. looks like I struck a raw nerve with the whole sharks suck thing. Yeah, you really hurt him. P.S. My mom says F you, and it's 17 meals. See, he was trying to jump in.
Oh,
you
yeah.
You can't beat this guy. He'll join him.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
So mom says hi. Al comes back with a comeback as lackluster as your work ethic. Keep up the good work? Question mark. Was it as lackluster a comeback as this gem below? Oh, yes, I did.
What?
He's referring to his earlier to
six tweets ago where Al said something.
Sure. I got four. Is it four or five now for Al?
Five. Al says, you struck a nerve? I'm laughing at you, much like the rest of the world does. Shouldn't you be working, you one insult F?
Beer Mugs Twitter War!
To which the Twitter warrior Mugs responds with, shouldn't you be working?
And scene.
One insult F is playing Weenie Roast. Are you mad you didn't get tickets?
Oh, my God.
Al, back to where we started from. File! Doesn't it get tiring being you? One terrible joke / life decision after another. Nope, unlike you, I have a fantastic job that doesn't involve hiding behind a keyboard, trolling the internet, talking S. Ah, says Al, now I see I've struck a nerve. No, it's okay, Beer Mug, you're doing a great job. I'm sorry you wasted time with a troll. Tell me about it! Maybe I can come to your workplace and tell you how much of a good job you're doing being a fluffer. Al responds with, Beer Mug. I say a fat joke, you say a gay joke. We're going nowhere. Unlike your weight, which is skyrocketing.
Beer Mug's Twitter war!
Why are fat jokes always funny?
Because they just are. Then Mugs proceeded to delete every tweet that they had over the past 7 hours. And Al came back with, and please tell me you didn't delete every tweet you made towards me. That would make you somehow even more sad than you are. But of course he had.
How do you feel about it in retrospect there, Muggs? How do you think you did?
Not good.
Yeah. Yeah. In general, your life?
Yeah.
Not good?
Not good. I think if we get to learn one lesson from all this, it's keep your face from behind your back, because if you don't, someone will S on it.
Twitter war!
Vampire Rika, another world famous K-Rock, 106.7 KROQ at 8 minutes after six.
Can I just say no now and just I'm speaking for the audience this time?
No. No, you cannot.
Look, a couple weeks ago, Dave was circulating a photo of a man with no butt crack, and I wouldn't look at that either. There are just some lines that need to be drawn, and this woman from My Strange Addiction is over my line. I don't want to hear about this.
My Strange Addiction from the TLC Network, which, of course, is the Freak Network.
My name is Keisha, and I'm expecting my first child, and I love sniffing and chewing dirty diapers.
Well, she's got to be in heaven. She's expecting her first child.
She's pregnant.
Where was she getting? I have so many questions for this woman that I don't want to know anything about. Where was she getting the dirty diapers from before if she hasn't had a baby?
She has friends, and they have babies, and she'll walk into the house and say, oh, that diaper needs to be changed. I'll take that one. And she also goes through trash cans.
Oh.
Really? I keep some in my trunk. I keep some in my pocketbook. If I go out to eat, I have a diaper. This is good. It's nasty.
She's even willing to dig in the garbage for her diapers.
It came from my kid, and I don't even want it near me. I'm going to smell them just one last time.
No.
Guess who that guy is?
Is that her husband?
Uh-uh.
Who's that?
Fiance. This chick who smells and chews diapers has somebody who's going to marry her.
What is wrong with him?
I may regret asking this question.
Away.
But how are these diapers dirty?
Well, this might surprise you, B. It's not quite as bad as you thought. It's a number one.
Okay.
But a little better.
There's no two involved.
All right.
Okay, good.
You know, when you're going through the trash for diapers, you're going to run across a two.
Right, well, right. You toss it back, I think.
Right, but you're going through the dirty diapers.
Well, that is happening.
Holy crap.
It has to have pee in it. This one's soft.
Come on. I couldn't even be her friend.
I couldn't either. You think there...
She's not trying to get over this?
You think there was a meeting at the TLC network where they debated whether they could put this on television or not?
They're like, you know what? This may be too much.
It may be too much.
But they don't...
Maybe too strange an addiction.
But they don't show a lot of it. There's not a lot of explicit conversation about exactly how she does it. She just finds it pleasing.
Right, but she's putting diapers in her mouth and sucking on them. Urine-soaked diapers.
Well, don't make it worse. Let's go with number one, Bean.
Okay.
Because that makes everything better.
I want to take this one off of her here.
Oh, my God.
She's going to cry.
We're going to take this one off. Yeah, this is ready to go.
This is ready to go. Now, that's her best friend who has a kid.
Oh, God.
So she goes over and literally takes the baby and changes the diaper because it's, quote, ready to go.
She wants it.
Yeah.
How can you... I can't...
How would you ever begin something like this?
My addiction to diapers started about 3 years ago. One of my friends was changing her baby, and she gave me the diaper to throw out. And I kept it for like a week, and I smelt it like every morning, night.
This is the editorial music. One of her friends gave her a diaper to throw away that minute. She kept it for a week. What's going on?
Are you guys kidding?
It's weird. It's gross. You really have to stop. Because that's embarrassing.
Yeah. Fiance and friend.
Now, guys, this is mental illness, right?
I would guess so.
It is.
So as in all shows with My Strange Addiction, they either take you to a doctor or a therapist. In this particular place, they went right for the therapist. They didn't worry about the doctor.
Explain it to me. Tell me. You have the diaper.
Like I actually have one.
So, let me see. So you sniff and then you...
Okay, so she actually has a diaper in her purse at the time when she goes to therapy.
And then you nibble? Well, how do you feel now that you're about to give birth and have your own supply?
I feel great.
It's all good. Why would I feel any different?
Right.
And that's everybody's biggest concern is she's about to give birth and that means endless supply of this particular problem.
We may never be able to stop this woman from having babies.
Let's find out what the therapist's advice is for somebody who is doing this.
This may not be what you want to hear, but if something is detrimental to your health, unborn child, your relationship, and it should be stopped.
Should be stopped. Mm-hmm. So that's a surprise. No one could have seen that coming from the doctor or therapist. All right, here's where we guess. Let's have at it, people.
Oh, there's no way she gives it
up.
Does
she quit?
She is delighted with her addiction. She loves it.
I don't think so either. When she's got that supply right around the corner,
yeah.
there's no way. This is the perfect time.
This baby can't come soon enough.
Yeah, you don't quit skiing on your way to Aspen, all right?
The therapist, she helped me to realize it's more to it than just myself.
Huh?
What?
Maybe a breakthrough?
I do want to stop, but it's going to take time.
Yeah. She's still doing it to this day. Yep. My Strange Addiction. Oh.
Good morning. Good morning.
Yum, yum, yum.
Fabulous. Outstanding. Wonderful. Terrific. Good morning.
Who's hungry?